Welcome to the Knowledge for Teachers podcast. My name is Brendan Lee, and on this podcast, I speak with researchers, teachers, and experts about what evidence-informed practice is and the nuances involved with actually implementing effective and sustainable school-based education. Before we start, I would like to acknowledge the land that we are all on today. I am on the beautiful land of the Darug and Gundungurra people in the Lulgbalee Mountains of New South Wales, Australia. I would like to pay respect to the elders both past, present, and emerging, who are the traditional custodians of this country. As we learn together today, I would like to extend that respect to any Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people listening today. This land always was and always will be the land of the First Nations people. In this episode, I speak with Tom Bennett, the Director and Founder of Research Ed and School Behaviour Advisor to the UK Government. He shares his journey from running nightclubs to becoming an influential figure in the education sector. We also find out how teaching saved him. Tom delves into the challenges he faced as a teacher, how he got into writing about educational behaviour, and his eventual role as the UK's Department of Education School Behaviour Advisor. He highlights the integral role of setting clear behavioural expectations in creating a conducive learning environment. Tom also discusses the creation and implementation of a behaviour curriculum and the origins of Research Ed. Unbelievably, throughout this conversation, he manages to mention Kate Middleton, Professor Snape, Dead Poets Society, Being a Pebble in a Stream, X-Men, and G.I. Joe. So, without further ado, here is my conversation with Tom Bennett. Really excited to introduce Tom Bennett today. Tom is the founder and director of Research Ed, behavior guru, and author of a book that I feel every teacher should be given when starting out teaching called Running the Room. Tom, are you able to tell us a bit about your journey into the position that you're in today?
You're a good man, Brendan. Thanks for having me on. That's a very kind introduction. What the journey to becoming the man that I am. Yeah, I mean, what's to say, really? I started off as a teacher for like 14, 15 years, teacher and leader, mostly in very challenging inner city London schools. Before that, I used to run nightclubs in Soho in the West End of London, which is kind of like a natural progression into teaching, I fear. You know, I think it's just the normal next step. Once you've done that for a while, you become a teacher. And then, so once I became a teacher, I loved it, but it was awful. It was a horrible struggle, and it was mainly because I had no idea what to do. And I found that the teacher prep program I was on, which was a good one, it's world renowned, left me completely unready for the challenges of the classroom. I didn't know how to manage classrooms. Mm. You know, which you would hope would be somewhere in your teacher prep program. So I struggled, but it kind of made a lot of sense to me. The job itself, it gave me a lot of purpose. I always say teaching saved me. And then I did that for a while. And I love to write, so I started to write about teaching. I think, you know, this is the path that many people take. You know, you start to write online and you do blogs and you tweet and all the rest of it. And amazingly, I started to kind of get the attention of like ministers and stuff like this who liked what I said. I started to write for the TES, which is like a UK trade paper for teachers. And I do a lot of stuff in behaviour. And then I started to work in the behaviour sphere. And I started to go into schools and try to find out what it was that good people were doing to get great behaviour. And I think I've been to about 965 schools now. I keep a rough track, which doesn't make me any better than anyone else. But I have seen a lot of very, very good practice. And that's what I try to distill. And then about 10 years ago, I was asked to be the UK's Department for Education School Behaviour Advisor. So I can give advice, which is independent. And help them to write policy and help them to write new strategies when it comes to behaviour. So I've been kind of doing that in the UK and around the world for what feels like a million years. But it's a joy to be doing that. And here I am. And to be honest, you know, it was all just a build-up to this moment, to being on your podcast. And so, you know, thank you for really tying the ribbon on this career arc.
Well, look, there's a couple of things that you said there that I'd just like to dig into a little bit. The first thing is, you know,
oh God, what have I said?
Well, you went from running nightclubs into teaching. Firstly, was there any crossover in the skills that you developed running nightclubs? And secondly, you also mentioned how it was quite difficult to actually transition and the behaviour stuff was one of the tricky aspects. Was that because you couldn't just throw kids out of the classroom like you could in a nightclub?
But I want to just stress something here. You know, I wasn't secretly wishing I could just bin kids. You know, that was never. And also, when you're on nightclubs, you know, you don't think, you know, I can't wait to throw everyone out. You know, you want them to come in and have a good time. You want them to be happy. Yeah. And you know, you want to put the pee in the party. But I think one of the things that nightclubs did teach me was that, was, and it's this phrase I keep coming back to, running the room, that you're not just getting people in, giving them drinks, and then, you know, playing loud music. I mean, you are doing that. But you're also, you're in charge of them. You're in charge of their safety. You're in charge of them not getting too drunk. You're in charge of them, you know, when they get hammered and when they become helpless, as they frequently do, and somebody pickpockets them, or they lose their, you know, they lose their keys, or they lose their wallet or something, and they're in tears and you have to get them home somehow, but they can't tell you where they live because they're hammered. You know, there's a lot of duty of care there. And I often thought there was a lot in that, which goes into schools. But of course, I mean, when you run a club, you don't really learn about behavior management. But you interact with people a lot, and it does teach you a lot about how to talk to people. And people who are drunk are very like small children, you know, especially when you try and get them in and out of cars, right? It's a very similar experience. And I realized that, you know, that for instance, if you're a bouncer, people often say, I was a bouncer. Well, it's just, it's the weirdest thing. But I worked with bouncers a lot. I've been on the door a lot. And if you want to get somebody out of a club, you can either punch them in the face and throw them out, which is, you know, not recommended, or you can persuade them to leave. Now, let me suggest to you that the latter is a far more healthy and safe way of doing things. And the best, for example, nightclub security I've ever met were really, really good at saying to people, look, you know, it's time to leave. I don't want you to get in trouble. Except, you know, that kind of thing. Now, when it comes to behavior management in schools, the reason why it was so hard was because nobody showed me what to do. Nobody ever said, this is how you manage behavior. You know, and I remember when I asked people, well, what do I do? You know, I'm really struggling with the behavior. The kids won't do what I ask. You know, they don't want to do the work. And this was in some really challenging inner city schools where the kids just did not give a damn. And they were lovely, you know, in many ways lovely people, but they just couldn't see the point of any subject. And I would ask my mentors, you know, what do we do? And they would just give you the most vague, absurd advice, like, you need to build a relationship with them, Tom. You know, that kind of thing. It's not wrong, but it's useless advice. You know, it's like saying to a comedian, you need to be funny. You know, I mean, yeah, it's true, but how? What do you want me to do? And or if you go, imagine if you went to a car mechanic and said, you know, car's not working. And the mechanic said, yeah, you need to get that fixed. I mean, yes, you're right. But what and how? So it was full of this kind of junk. And really, it was largely because, I mean, I've done a lot of investigations into this now in my job at the DfE. It's largely because it is almost entirely absent from teacher prep. It wasn't just me. There was the entire system which was geared up against the idea of teaching explicitly what teachers need to do to get good behavior. So, I mean, it was only partially my fault.
The other thing that you spoke about earlier was how teaching saved you. What did you mean by that?
Oh, I knew you'd pick up on that. Yeah, I could see you. A flash went over there. Well, it's just that I had left university with a degree in philosophy, which made me entirely unemployable, and I loved that. You know, I'm not decrying philosophy, but it meant that, and I didn't have any connections, and I was the first generation of my family to go to university, and I was completely lost. I didn't know what to do with this degree. I didn't know anybody in any kind of industry that could help. So I fell into the jazz and liquor world of nightclubs. And it was fun for a while, but, you know, it's kind of a burnout career. And I did that for about 8 years. And I just felt completely, I felt purposeless. You know, as somebody said, was it Keats? He said, most men live lives of quiet desperation. And I don't know if you've ever been, and I hope you haven't, but many people have been in that place where you've no idea what to do with your life. You've got this terribly deep, deep feeling that you're not doing what you should be doing, and that you're kind of wasting your life, and you're just passing the time, and it's just going to keep going on forever. Quiet desperation. And teaching saved me in that respect. I remember just seeing the adverts and thought, what the hell am I doing? This is what I should be doing, which doesn't mean I started doing it and had some kind of great Dead Poets Society moment where all the kids just leapt on the table and said, "Oh, captain, my captain." I mean, maybe that happens for you, Brendan. But I'm sure it does, actually. I'm sure you do. I'm sure you're one of the sickeningly good teachers. But it gave me purpose and meaning. And I realized that there's nothing more important than that in life. To do something that you think matters is so, so important. And it's not that it has to be fun. As most meaningful things are, but it matters, because it means that you matter to some extent.
Yeah, no, look, what you're saying really resonates with me because I mentioned to you briefly before we started recording that I was previously a high school teacher or secondary teacher and transitioned into primary. But in between that, I actually left teaching for a couple of years. And one of the main reasons behind that was because of exactly what you're talking about, where I just lost that connection to what I was doing, didn't build sense of purpose, you know, probably felt, quite a bit demoralized with what I was doing. And so I left and went into hospitality, similar to what you were doing.
Oh, really?
I opened up a cafe. You know,
amazing.
Whole other story that one is. But, learn a lot of life lessons. But as you would know, it's the hospitality business. It's a tough gig. And, eventually I kind of got itchy feet.
Sorry, I thought you were going to say that you kind of wandered the earth for a year like Bruce Banner in the old version of the Hulk. You know, you were trying to find yourself.
Yes.
Oh, the cafe, pretty cool. Yeah. That's great. It was great that you did that. And I think that's a wonderful thing to do. And, you know, I know a friend of mine who's a priest with the Anglican Church, and he says that every like 10 years or something, they get like a 6-month paid sabbatical. And they get to do anything they want, you know, the good golf and be working a circus or something like that. Just reboot the batteries. So anyway, that's what we should do.
Yeah, for sure. I found like when I did return and I returned as a primary teacher, I had this, you know, new sense of purpose in what I was doing. Yeah. And just that time to reflect on things, it gave me that kind of that boost I needed, like a born again teacher in a way.
Yeah.
So look, I guess you've kind of alluded to it in a way, but like, how did you fall into this role of being a behavior specialist?
Oh yeah. I mean, I kind of glazed over that because I get asked that sometimes I get asked that by people who want to do it, you know, and it's a bit like asking somebody, you know, any kind of career path. It's not the kind of thing that there's a particular path to do, you know, you find your own path and then retrospectively you look back and say, oh yeah, I could see that was my path. You know, those are the steps that brought me here. But there are other paths that could take you there, if that isn't too Buddhist. And my path was basically struggling with behavior, but wanting to get better. So I read everything I could about it, and it wasn't very helpful. Most of the books out at the time were frankly terrible. they were incredibly well-meaning, but they were vague, or they seemed to assume that children were just deep down intrinsically always lovely. And that you just had to say a kind word and they would they'd be leaping on their tables. Well, they leapt on their tables for me, but not in the right way. And so I read everything I could, and I started to write about behavior. I started to write about my experience of behavior. But at this point, I was starting to get better, but it really was trial and error. And I was really feeling in the darkness as to how to work with kids and how to build relationships with individuals and with a class. And I started to write my thoughts down and send them into teaching magazines because I love to write, you know, and anyone that likes writing will know what I mean. You know, you just feel like you've got to write. It's kind of just what you do. I started to write those things. I started to get invited into schools to see how they manage behavior. And that was a real catalyst for me because I started to see what really effective practice looked like in lots of different classrooms and schools. And it could look, and there was lots of similarities and there were lots of differences. And I started to develop a kind of broader understanding of what behavior management looked like in the primary sector, the secondary sector, the mainstream sector, the alternative needs sector, and so on. And that was such a great education for me. And from then, it started to build. I wrote a book about my experiences. And, you know, they were okay books. I mean, I've written better. And then I started to, you know, work with schools. And then I kind of started to make the jump into giving advice on what I'd seen, if that makes sense. And then I think gasp really put my type when the then Minister for Education in the UK, Michael Gove, he used to read my stuff online and he really liked it. And he used to bring me in and ask for advice and so on. And then he and subsequent ministers elected me to this post of behavior. Well, the press call it behavior czar, which is really unhelpful, but you know, independent behavior advisor skills. And it's just gone from there. And now I work, you know, 80% of my time in the behavior field, and I go to about 5 schools a week, and I coach them, and I coach leaders and staff. But I also try to learn from every school I go to. And one of the amazing things I love is that a successful school can look very different from another successful school. You know, there's no one ideal school, and I've been to schools from Sydney to West Bank. Schools can be very different and be successful, but chaotic schools always look the same. So, you know, there's a lesson for us there, I hope.
you've copped a lot of kickback over the years, even in here in Australia. The media's jumped on board, and yeah. So you know, how have you dealt with that?
What, psychologically or practically? So first of all, I'll tell you my secret in a second. Right? I'll tell you my secret. This is good. This is my secret. But before that, education is an ideological wasteland, right? Or a battlefield, one of the two. I mean, battlefields lead to wastelands, so I'm sure that metaphor will do. Education is about what we think it means to be a human being and what the type of human beings we want to recreate on a generational basis, right? So it's fundamental to a lot of moral and, I guess, often political reasoning. And some people think that education is fundamentally to breed, I don't know, the next generation of activists. And some people think education is to you know, teach the best of what we've known. And some people think it's a bit critical. You know, there's all kinds of aims. And that's good. That's all well and good. You know, I'm down with that, as I say, because I don't think it's up to me to say, here's what education should be for. Education's got multiple aims. But it also means that when you say anything in education, somebody's going to throw a brick at you. And more broadly, and perhaps this is a more political point, when you stand for anything at all, someone will try and cut you down. And that's good and bad. You know, I mean, I used to teach ethics as part of my philosophy course. And, you know, we would do, you know, the old classics like euthanasia or abortion as a discussion point, right? And if somebody said, I am pro-euthanasia, someone else would say, you know, you monster. And if someone else said, I'm anti-euthanasia, someone else would say, you monster. You know, and it taught me very quickly that if you stand for anything, somebody will throw a brick at you. And if you say, and you can say something really innocent, like, you know, I quite like jam, and somebody will say, your silence on cheese is very telling. You know, people like to get the hump. People like to get upset by things, and they find their tribes. They find their tribes about whom to get upset. And so it really bothers me that people get upset and a couple little flack, because there's a lot to change in education. There's a lot that's broken, and there's a lot that needs fixing. And for decades and decades, education has been in the hands of what I call a priest caste of people who've got very well good intentions, but we all know what road is path with those, but who are essentially 19th century philosophers who couldn't manage a challenging class and don't understand the first thing about the evolving and new appreciation and approaches in what's sometimes called the science of learning. And so there's a lot to change. There's a lot that doesn't work. And I'm happy to try and change that, because kids matter and their success and their safety matters. And I couldn't give a damn about what other people think of that. I really couldn't, because that matters to me, and children matter to me and their safety and success. So when people get upset online and kind of vilify me sometimes, that's on them, because I know that I've got, you know, many, many people out there who in a community of which I am part, of people who think, yeah, no, this is what we should be doing. And that heartens me and that reassures me. And I remember in the old days, I'm talking about 10 years ago now, it used to bother me, online in particular, because online used to be a lovely experience. You know, you just had people who just agreed with you. And then eventually you get to a certain platform, you get to a certain number of followers, for example. And I don't mean to flatter myself. It should, you know, just happens eventually if you're persistent. And eventually you start picking up some crazies, and you start picking up some really mean people, and you start picking up people who don't give a damn about you and just want to have a pop at you because it makes them feel good about themselves, because, you know, because their pizza hasn't been delivered yet, and you know, the mom hasn't unlocked the basement door. So they think, you know, let's get online and see what Tom Bennett's up to. Fine, you know, let them dangle. But it used to upset me. Mm-hmm. And I remember once I was doing a thing years ago. I'd been nominated for what was called the Global Teacher Prize, right? You know, I mean that and $1.50 will get you a cup of coffee. And so I went to, I know, I'm playing it down. I was really pleased at the time, right? I was really, really thrilled. And they flew me over to Dubai for this big kind of gala event. And honestly, I was on top of the world. I could not have been happier. And I was organizing an event in New York. It's the first time I've done a research event in America. So I'm organizing an event in New York from the UK. It's the bizarrest thing. And all of a sudden there was a big Twitter pile on for some, you know, because, you know, I can't even remember now. There was somebody got upset about one of the speakers. And I got like the 5-minute hate for like a day. But it was only about 25 people, but it feels like the world, you know, when you're online. And you all of a sudden there's people being really mean to you, and it really upset me. I was like, oh my God, that's horrible. It's horrible. Am I a bad person? What would that? And then I've had that so often now that genuinely, here's my secret. I was promised I was going to tell you a secret, Brendan. There's a couple of things here in the secret. So the reason why I am completely at ease with this now is, number one, I'm right. I'm pretty convinced I'm right on this stuff, which doesn't mean I can't be wrong. And I know I can be disproved, but I've been doing this stuff for so long now. I know I'm on the right path with a lot of the stuff I'm doing, although I might be wrong in some other ways. In general, I'm pretty confident that, you know, behavior is important and that cognitive psychology is important. So number one, I'm right. Number two, I don't care about them. What I care about a stranger. Actually, there's a less polite way of expressing that I normally do, but, you know, I don't care. And if you care about somebody, they can hurt you. Mm. Why should I care what, you know, Angry Bob 36905 sitting in Nebraska in his underpants, you know, what he thinks about me? Well, if you broaden it to that point, you'll go crazy. And I'm sorry, I'm going to finish this rather long-winded point on, are you familiar with the work of the X-Men? Are you familiar with the X-Men comic or film series? Right. Okay. And so I say that like it's some kind of like, you know, Greek classic. There's a character in the X-Men called Professor X, Charles Xavier. And he's great, right? And in the comics and in the film sometimes, he's a telepath. This is for your listeners who have been in a box for the past 20 years. So he's a telepath. And he can read people's minds. And in the comics and the film, sometimes he plugs himself into this big supercomputer, magnifies his power enormously. But sometimes it goes too far. And all of a sudden, he can hear the thoughts and feel the emotions of everybody on the planet. And it overwhelms him. And sometimes it drives him mad. And, you know, he has a psychic shock and falls in. We are all now Professor X sitting in that chair. You can turn on your computer, you can open up your phone, and you can instantly be privy to the thoughts and feelings and pointless expressions of opinion of a million people at once, right? We were not designed for that. We were designed to have small groups of close friends and outer circles of less close friends and so on. And that's a healthy thing. That's a healthy, normal thing for our brains to do. We've probably evolved to that level of social interaction. What we haven't, what we're not very good at dealing with is dealing with everybody's thoughts at once. And so I block, like, you know, like I'm giving myself a present. You know, I block freely and quickly. If someone comes up to me and says, you're an asshole, I just go, okay, goodbye. Because I wouldn't allow that in a normal social interaction. If somebody walked up to me in the bar and said, hi, you're an asshole, I would probably say, okay, goodbye. What I wouldn't do is say, you know what? Let's discuss that point for 10 minutes. Let me give you 10 minutes of my life that I could be sitting talking to my children. But I'm going to talk to you about this. Forget it. You know, life is too short. If people want to do pylons, let them do pylons. You know, I'm like the Zen rock. I let the water wash over me. I'm like a pebble in a stream, Brendan. A pebble in a stream. Anyway, this has been Tom Bennett, Zen Philosophy. Being well, being the king of his own cam kingdom. Thanks very much.
It's been a pleasure.
Oh, that's it. We can stop the episode now. I think you've said enough.
Yeah, absolutely. My pleasure.
Look, besides being, you know, a rock and a pebble, you have actually written a really, really good book. As I said at the start of the show, I think it's one of those books which every beginning teacher should get their hands on. I feel it would save them a hell of a lot of issues and stress and drama that they are almost forced to go through because they're not prepared, as you mentioned earlier. And so, yeah, I'd like to just dig into some of the points that you've made there, because I think you've worded them, some of these points, really well, but I would like you just to kind of expand on them a little bit. So the first one here is, being well-behaved is a combination of skills, aptitudes, habits, inclinations, values, and knowledge. These can be taught. Can you just talk to that and just explain how this might be a bit of a mind shift for many teachers?
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, the state of behavior management training is so bad internationally that you're almost starting with almost nothing. And I mean that quite consciously and deliberately. I mean, I've seen This isn't to decry the Australian systems or the American systems or the UK systems in particular. You know, it's an international issue. And we've moved the dial a bit in the UK, but only because we've really been focusing on it. You know, but we're not some kind of like, you know, oh my God, we're doing it so much better than everyone else. But we are doing it well, I think. It's got better. But what I find is that for a lot of teachers, they're taught almost nothing about behavior management. And they're told you'll just pick it up as you go along. So you're basically told nothing. And then you can work out by trial and error in your classroom how to get kids to do what you want them to do. And you might not become fantastic or brilliant at it, but you get by. Or maybe you do get brilliant at it. Or maybe you don't need to get brilliant at it because the children you teach they're already brimming with high levels of social skills and aptitudes and values that help them to succeed and flourish. And I think that, you know, this is the state of play we have where it's like the Wild West. So when I say things like behavior is a series of beliefs, knowledge, and skills, it's a big mindset shift for many teachers who may not have a clear idea about where behavior is coming from or what you know, what's informing it. So the way I try to explain it is this. Some kids come from really fortunate socioeconomic circumstances, and they tend to become habituated into behaviors that help them become successful, for example, in institutional settings. And it could be really simple stuff like how to wait your turn, how to share, how to say please and thank you. That's not necessarily always going to be down to affluence, but affluence is a big factor in that. You know, it's not the only one, of course it's not. And then you get kids from the other end of the spectrum who grow up in an environment which might be toxic or neglectful or abusive and so on. And they learn different habits of behavior. And those habits might, you know, be, I wouldn't say appropriate, but it makes sense to them for where they are, but it might not be useful in an institution. So a kid might grow up in a abusive home and they learn to fight back a lot, you know, but if they do that in school, they'll get in trouble, right? And this is all bound to one simple premise that we're not born with our behaviors, that when we're born, we don't know how to do anything. You know, like some animals are born, they're just ready to go. They are just ready to go. You look at a fruit fly, the noble Drosophila melanogaster, right? When he or she is born, they've got a 72-hour lifespan. They just get busy. They wake up, they go, boom, I'm a fruit fly. I'm gonna fruit fly for 3 days solid, you know, and they eat and all the rest of it. You know, nobody shows them. All that stuff is hardwired. But kids, people, we're different. We've got big brains, very extended infancies, which is why we need lots of child rearing. Big brains, we know stuff, but we don't know it from birth. We're taught stuff. We're very good at generational inheritance education. And so, you know, this is one of the things that's fundamental to understanding about human nature. We're not born knowing how to hold a knife and fork or use chopsticks, you know, or shake hands or bow. None of these things are born within us. We're taught this stuff, our social habits of behavior. So some kids get loads of that, some kids don't, and everyone else gets something in between. And they come to us, whether they're 4 years old or 14 years old, and some of them are brimming with dispositions and values and habits where they're already going to do quite well at school because they just know how to operate and they know how to successfully do it. But a lot of kids don't. They've got different ideas about good behavior. So our job is to teach these behaviors to kids. And if you go to like a kindergarten or an early years environment, they do this all the time. This is like 90% of what we do in kindergarten. Here's how to share. Here's how to say please and thank you. Here's what to do if you need help. Here's what to do if you're upset. You know, here's what to do if you're tired. All this kind of stuff. We're teaching behavioral habits and values at the same time. And so that's why I talk a lot about the behavior curriculum and this idea that schools have kind of got a duty to do this. And I work with a lot of schools from right across the social spectrum. And if you go to like a really good independent school or, you know, like a really, really posh, expensive independent school, right? And you get kids there who have been raised in the most fortunate circumstances. And the behavior profile is normally pretty good in these environments. I'm not saying it has to be good. I'm not saying it's always good behavior. There's always bad behavior somewhere. But the behavior profile is very different to a really challenging school in some inner city environment. And those teachers often think, oh, we're great at behavior. And what they mean is we've got some really highly socialized kids here. I can't remember if that even answered your question, but you know, but I enjoyed the journey.
Yeah, no, definitely. And look, I think a lot of teachers can suffer from the old curse of knowledge as well, where, you know, they forget how little our children or students actually know about how to operate at school
absolutely.
Or how to behave. And, it comes back to assuming that they should know how to do these things, but if they haven't necessarily been taught it, then we're kind of setting them up for failure.
Yeah. Let me give you a perfect example, Brendan, of how this plays out in the teacher sphere as well. So if you've got a teacher and they've just finished a prep program, they're through induction or whatever process you have, and they're now a full-time classroom teacher. But problem is, the classroom's going crazy. When I say going crazy, like five or six kids are really, really hard work. Two kids tell you to F off, three kids storm out, the usual kind of nonsense. And they go to their mentor or their line manager or their pastoral leader or somebody, and they say, man, I'm really struggling here. And the advice given is, right, you need to really improve the behavior in this classroom. That's your focus for the next 6 weeks, behavior. And, and it's a bit like relationships. It's like, okay, I understand, and I understand the word, but I don't know how to do it. And when we ask people to do those types of things, it's the old curse of knowledge or the curse of expertise. We're assuming that people are competent at things that we find easy. But that, if you're an educator, that's fatal. Because, if you assume that, then you won't be able to understand why a four-year-old can't do number bonds, up to 20 or something like that. You won't understand. You'll talk to a kid and say, why can't you do your six times table? This is easy. It's not. It's not easy if you can't do it. And if you're a novice teacher or a novice student, unfamiliar with the behaviors associated with the rule, you're going to struggle. So what we have to, instead of just giving them these big abstract instructions, we've got to go back to the basics and say, this is what I need you to do. Do this.
Yeah, well said. Look, next one I want to unpack a bit is you wrote in Running the Room, routines are the building blocks of the classroom culture.
Yeah.
Routine behavior must be taught, not told. So how can teachers build routines and why are they important?
Oh, that's a big one. Oh, that's a whole lecture day. Well, let me try and summarize. So routines are the building blocks because, most people will be familiar with some level of understanding like cognitive load theory. The idea that our working memory, our thinking memory is quite narrow. We can only think about a few things at once before we get overloaded. But our long-term memory is where you want to put stuff so you can remember it and retrieve it and recall it. The same thing applies to behavior to some extent, that most of our behaviors that we exhibit are automatic. They're fairly routine. They are habitual, in other words. We just act the way we do. I didn't decide to sit the way I'm sitting. It just feels right. It's probably got something to do with my habits. It's like blinking, although that's not a habit, that's more of an instinctive behavior or reflex behavior. And as soon as you start thinking about blinking, you can never quite work out, am I blinking now because I want to blink, or am I blinking because my body is blinking? And it's, you just stop thinking about it because it's too uncomfortable. Most of the behaviors we perform are habitual, and that's a good thing, because otherwise we'd be overloaded all the time and we wouldn't be able to cope in a complex world. Do you remember when you first started to drive? If you drive, sorry, I'm assuming. But you look like a competent man. You look like a driver. And you find...
Yes, I can drive.
Yeah, thank you. Just establishing that for the podcast. And you find that, everything's very conscious. And I used to, when I started to drive, I used to like verbalize everything I did. I would say things like, I'm going into second gear now. But you can't have a conversation and do that, or indeed a relationship. So it's one of those things that you internalize until now you can drive completely habitually. It's so deep down, you don't even think about it. And that's why routines matter, because we want children to possess loads and loads and loads of deep stored memory bank routines of how to get on in a school without really thinking about it. It needs to be a habit. So we have, and I find that most behavior in school can be systematized. It's because you're doing the same thing over and over again. You turn up to a room. So what do you do when you go into the room? You leave the classroom. So what do you do when you leave the classroom? You're stuck. So what do you do then? Are you walking along a corridor? How do you walk down a corridor? Most of that becomes internalized. But for some kids, they're not sure. They've got their own idea. They think different things are okay. So we have to systematize the routines. And we teach these routines. Well, this is the joy of it. This is the joy of what I call the behavior curriculum. We can apply pedagogy to this process. We teach the behaviors we want to see. And instead of just thinking, what behavior do I want to ban? Which is important, because you've got to ban some stuff. You've got to prohibit. Kids need boundaries. But within those boundaries, teach the kids what you actually want them to do. And that's something which can be done pedagogically. In the same way that you can teach someone to swing a tennis racket or conjugate a verb or perform trigonometry or, you know, or walking a tightrope. These things can all be taught. And this is why I call behavior largely a package of knowledge, skills, habits. You wrap them all together and it becomes your behavior. You can teach it. You can sit there and say, right, guys, this is how we're going to line up inside the classroom. So you teach them, you tell them, you quiz them, you check their understanding, you get them to repeat it back to you. They can do a poster, you know, whatever you want. Then you get them to do the line. Is it single file? Is it side by side? Who cares? I don't care. What matters is what you want. And then once they're done at line, you give them feedback on it, like you would with any teaching. You say, right, that's not a bad line. How can we improve it? Ryan, you tell me. Jessica, what should we do now? Great. Let's try it one more time. Perfect. That's what I want to see outside my classroom every day. Thanks so much, guys. That's awesome. You know? And then you insist upon it day by day by day. You begin with a teachable moment. And then you reinforce it by reminding them, which is retrieval practice. So, you know, this is all science of learning stuff. This is all cognitive psychology. This is all, you know, fairly well-founded pedagogical principles, which are, you know, reasonably secure and robust. And we apply this to things like a routine as well.
Yeah, it's so vital. And, you know, I've seen so many schools that once they have started to implement these routines, not only do the kids get it, but then the teachers actually start to be able to do their job properly as well.
Absolutely, you know, because I don't want kids. So kids have got a limited bandwidth of being able to think about stuff. And so do you, so do I. You know, I couldn't do this podcast and read a book. You know, you just can't. We can't split out the attention. So you focus on something and you do it well or as well as you can. Apologies to the people who have to listen to me. And I don't want kids thinking about their behavior. I don't want teachers having to think too much about behavior either. I want kids thinking about science and poetry and music and all the magic that we're trying to teach them at school. That's what I want them thinking about. All the other stuff, I want it just to be automatic. I want them just to, you know, scrape their plate in the canteen the way that we want them to scrape the plates. I want them to walk on the left if we want them to walk on the left. You know, the more automatic that becomes, the easier it all gets for everyone else. The analogy I always use is like driving on the road. You know, you drive on the proper side of the road and everyone just gets by fine. You know, and in actual fact, it enables everyone else to flourish. It enables everyone else to achieve their aims, your individual aims, by just agreeing this is how we're going to behave with each other. And that relationship you have with society and with other people, including strangers, is how we flourish. It's the bedrock of civilization. It's the bedrock of community, and it's the bedrock of a school.
Mm. Look, I really enjoyed how you wrote about social norms and, you know, creating that classroom environment.
Sure.
What sort of things can teachers be doing to shape that environment?
Oh, that's a great one. I mean, so social norms, I mean, they're essentially a variation on the idea of a routine, you know, something which should be normal. And the reason why I talk about social norms is because human beings are very attracted to social norms. This is called social proof theory. And the idea that when we see a lot of people behaving a certain way, it gives us a strong sense of permission to also act that way. In fact, it can be quite attractive to act that way because we might want to be part of the group. And we human beings are very, very, you know, group-based. We're very social creatures. I mean, even crazy loners find other crazy loners with whom to hang out with. You know, welcome to the internet, right? You know, you find your people. And you can be parts of lots of different subcultures, and that's great. But what we find is that because people don't like to be ostracized, they don't like to be excluded, no one likes to feel like, you know, you're the odd one out, that we tend to copy the norms of the people around about us. And we see this in every environment. If you get onto a bus, a public bus, or the underground in London, or the tube or something like that, you know, everyone just behaves the same way. And for instance, on the London tube, I don't know if you've got experience of that, it's all kind of eyes down, no eye contact, be quiet, hold the strap, sit down, get into your phone, you know, it's all very bubbles. And when people break that convention, you know, nobody knows where to look. If you go to a library, everyone goes quiet. You go to a football match, all of a sudden it's, you know, foam fingers and chanting. Chanting, that sounds like a ritual sacrifice, but you know what I mean. You go to a ritual sacrifice and it's all chanting, right? Right, Brendan, right? And so we find that social norms really matter. And we find that's what we're trying to build in a classroom. So the way we build that in a classroom is by teaching routines, demonstrating the types of behavior you want to see, spotlighting great role models for the behaviors you want to see, talking about the types of values you want to embody, like kindness, hard work or something like that, or sharing. But not just talking about values, rooting those values in specific behaviors that demonstrate the value. So it's no good saying to your class, we're all going to be kind to each other. Because it's a nice thing to say, but it doesn't change what they do. Because that may mean very different things to different people. So you say, we're all going to be kind to each other, which means I want you all to hold the door open for the person behind you coming in. Yeah. I expect you to do that now. Or we're all going to be kind to each other, which means if somebody gets something wrong, we're not going to laugh. We're going to understand that sometimes not getting something right is the first step to getting something right. That failure is important, and that everyone successful has to fail. You know, from Steve Jobs to Gandhi, and that's important. You know, you attach it to a behavior, because kids aren't often very good at grasping abstract, particularly very young children, and particularly children who may struggle with their behaviors for lots of reasons.
You've mentioned the behavior curriculum a few times today, but
I may have done.
I'd like to just get into some of the nitty gritty aspects of it. You know, so for instance, like when we're starting out with the behavior curriculum from a whole school perspective, how can schools actually work out, okay, what should we include? What do we not include? How do we even decide what needs to be included?
That's a great question. And it's actually an easier process than people imagine. But it's just something that often people don't approach from the right angle. It's basically this. I kind of alluded to this already. You sit down, whether you're the school leader or the principal, or maybe you're the leadership team or the governing body or whoever you are, you're the ones in charge. And you ask yourself, what school do we want to be? What does good behavior look like? What do I want them to actually do? Start with that. Really start with that. And then think about lots of different scenarios in your school environment. Think about corridors. What does good behavior look like in a corridor? I mean, literally, what do I want them to do? Walk on the left, walk on the right. Can they talk? Can they not talk? Can they talk, but to a certain volume? You know, are they allowed to stop and chat if they've got a minute? Or can they go to the toilet then? Or, you know, whatever. And then you ask yourself, okay, classrooms. What does good behavior look like in a classroom? Really get into the weeds on this one. What do I want them to do when they come in and leave and transition between activities? What do I want them to do when they're stuck? You know, that's a great behavior to teach somebody. What do you do when you're stuck? What do you do when you're sad or upset or being bullied, whatever? And you go through the whole school like that and you come up with a list, seriously, you know, an enormous big list of this is what good behavior looks like. These are the behaviors attached to what good behavior looks like. You then have a separate thought of what must they not do? What must they not do? And that might be they can't land in a corridor. They can't use racist language. They can't swear, you know, in an audible way. They can throw something a pen at somebody. You know, they can't leave the school premises. They can't leave the classroom without permission. Blah, 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 blah. Get into the weeds of it. You've got to be clear on this, because if you're not clear, they won't be clear. If you're not clear, the staff won't be clear and the children won't have an idea. They'll just bring their own behaviors in and do that. And that's how you start writing a behavior curriculum. And your behavior curriculum, then once you've done that, you then turn that into a training manual. You say, okay, these are the behaviors I expect to see. How am I actually going to communicate this to the people who have to do them? And you need the training manual for staff. I mean, literally, you train the staff in this stuff. And you also have a separate training manual for kids. What do the kids need to do? And then you get the staff to train the kids. And there's a kind of a cascaded responsibility there. But the leadership has to teach the staff and the staff have to teach the kids. And obviously you can have interplay between those two things. You know, maybe leadership teaches the kids too. But that's the basic model of it. And that's how you create a behavior curriculum. And that focus on here's what I need you to do. Here's what you will do here is really important.
Yeah. And so in terms of, once you've kind of got what things need to be included in your behavior curriculum, you started to roll out the teacher training, you've got your training manual, and so you're starting to implement it. What does this look like year on year? So how does it evolve from one year group to the next? What sorts of skills are being built on?
That's a really good question. So for example, I mean, I work with a lot of, I mean, you've been blessed enough to do different phases of and ages of children, so you'll appreciate this. And I could kind of sense that this is kind of where the question might even be partially coming from. Because you're right, expectations of behavior from an 18-year-old are very different from expectations of behavior from a 4-year-old. And also expectations of behavior from a 10-year-old can be very different to another 10-year-old, depending on, for instance, you know, where they are in their own biological and psychological development, or maybe there's difficulties in their circumstances or chaos in their private life, or they're working through some kind of additional learning need or something, you know. So there's lots of different kind of starting points for people, and I completely get that. What I would broadly say is that you need to have an age-appropriate expectation of behavior, but it's still going to be a high expectation. You know, so the average, you know, four-year-old probably can't sit still for an hour, right? So that, I mean, that would be an odd expectation for somebody who's 4 years old. So you would want to expect them to maybe to be kind to each other. And there's some lovely, you know, there's some lovely like age-appropriate, stage-appropriate type materials that you see. You know, you'll get the picture in the classroom that says, in this class we have kind eyes, kind hands, and kind mouth. And that might be your approach towards behavior in a you know, 4-year-old's classroom. That's, you use that as a prompt, and then you make it really concrete. So kind hands means not hitting people. Kind hands means passing things to people. Kind hands means keeping your hands to yourselves and not touching other people. You know, you unpack that throughout your relationship with kids, and that may be your expectation. Once they get to, for instance, 8 years old, you know, you definitely want to kind of graduate past that. And that's when you can start going into much more specific edicts and prescriptions. Like, this is exactly how I want you to do a show and tell presentation. This is exactly how I want you to come into the classroom. I want you to self-register. I want you to get a reading book. I want you to sit down quietly and so on. But you move the expectations up as they get older. And so by the time they get to kind of 10, 11, 12, I mean, expectations, broadly speaking, for most mainstream children can be quite, you know, they can be quite high. Because I think having a low expectation of a child is a great way of keeping them down. And that we've got to have high expectations for kids. And when they struggle with that, we can support them with it, but we've got to have high expectations for them. So you're absolutely right. It will move up the age ranges as you get higher and higher.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And yeah, I think the points that you're making there just means that, like, teachers, they need to be making sure that it's not just age appropriate, but appropriate for the students that are in front of them as well.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I would still say, though, that there's, in, for instance, like a mainstream classroom or you know, mixed, or we would call a comprehensive classroom, which is most classrooms in the UK, for example, the danger is you cannot have completely personalized expectations for everybody. And there will absolutely be a small subset of kids who may, for example, have exceptions made for them. In fact, that's encoded in our school law, you know, that if you've got kids with designated certified additional needs, that we have to make some kind of accommodation for them. And that's great. I mean, that's what a civilized society does. But for the vast majority of children, saying to them, keep to the left or keep to the right, you know, that's not an unreasonable expectation. And you might have expectations of everybody without exception, unless there's some exceptional circumstance. You know, I mean, I can't really think of many children with even quite pronounced exceptional needs who can keep to the left-hand side of the corridor. Unless they can't understand the concept of left and right, which does sometimes happen. But normally children like that have got much more specialist environments, because normally mainstream environments just can swamp and overwhelm them to some extent. But yeah, you keep the standards high for most kids. Otherwise, we start seeing things like, oh, you know, I mean, take an example which sounds a bit harsh, but it's worth saying. If you've got a little kid called Billy and he's 14 years old and his mum and dad are going through a divorce, and he's pretty upset about it, and the teacher says, can you take your jacket off, please? And he says, go F yourself, you know? Now, he's hurting. I get it. He's hurting. You know, we all know what it feels like to be dealing with too much. There's a couple of things that needs to happen to Billy in that scenario. Number one, he needs to be removed from the classroom for a start, right? Because he's massively infringed upon the dignity of a human being who didn't deserve to be told to F off, right? They didn't deserve it, and the class doesn't deserve that kind of psychic shock either. He needs to be giving before love. Are you okay? Is there anything we can do for you? Is there anything we can support you with? You know, can we help you with, maybe make an exception? Can you have to do your homework until 3 days later because we appreciate that you're going between houses and so on? But he also needs to acknowledge you did something wrong. Because the danger here is that because you care so much about him and his circumstances, you care in a way which actually hurts him. You teach him that it's okay to tell someone to F off if you're upset. You know, it's not okay to tell someone F off when you're upset. And as we grow, as we learn to be an adult, we learn that if you want to be a grown-up, that you've got to self-regulate, and that even when you're not feeling it, you've got to go, I'm not going to tell someone to F off. Otherwise, we're raising a generation of children who feel like they can do what they want because
because they feel like doing it. And, you know, and so it's a fine line to walk here. But so you make reasonable accommodations. It really absolutely needs to get extra support and counselling and help. And I've actually been through a situation like that, exactly like this, where, you know, we had an hour-long conversation about, you know, how awful it is to lose somebody and so on. And also, and you've got to own this. You've got to take responsibility here. You do not tell me F off again. I didn't deserve that. You know, and it's almost a kind of a counselling process. And there was also a sanction. There also was a sanction because that, you know, you can't tell a teacher to F off. It's really, really bad thing to do. Try doing that to a cop and then saying, yeah, but I was upset. try doing that in a relationship. You know, I hit my girlfriend. Why? I was upset. I was angry. Oh, it's okay. You were angry. That's fine. No, it's not fine. It really isn't fine to hit your girlfriend if you're angry. You know? And so that's why I say that at school, it's really important that we offer really high levels of challenge to theoretically or practically antisocial behavior. Because if we don't, we permit it and we encourage it.
Mm. And so where do things like rewards and consequences, where do they fit into all of this? And how should teachers use them?
Yeah. I mean, the rewards and things like sanctions get a really bad name sometimes. Because some people think that, you know, we're treating them like dogs. This is, and they say things like, this is behaviorism, as if that's like a bad thing. People often say to me things like, you know, sanctions and rewards don't work. Oh, really? So if you suddenly doubled the pay for being a teacher, do you think more people wouldn't start being a teacher? Of course they would, you know, because it becomes more attractive. Incentives matter. Or put it another way, I don't know what you have in Australia. In the UK, if we want to designate an area that you can't park in, we put double yellow lines next to the pavement, next to the sidewalk. What do you have? We have yellow lines? No. What's a no parking indicator?
Yeah, I don't think we really have lines, but we just have like a sign that, yeah.
You have a sign up through the sidewalk. Yeah. Wow, that's quite abstract. That requires a lot of attention. We paint a yellow line along the whole side of the road, right? Because we're dumb. But anyway, there's a reason why people don't park outside Buckingham Palace, right? There's a nice British metaphor for you. I said, "Buckingham Palace," because because you're not allowed to park there, and if you park there, you'll definitely get in trouble. You will lose your car, will be gone, along with Kate Middleton. It will be gone. And she'll be driving around Windsor somewhere, right, with Haile Selassie or something like that. Anyway, and so there's no community in the world that doesn't have penalties and rewards. It does not exist. And if anybody wants to give me a counterfactual, I'll happily view it. And I will show you a society that didn't last for very long. You know, every society, every community has to have boundaries of acceptable behavior and consequences for crossing those boundaries. And if you remove that, your society disintegrates. You know, discuss, but I won't hold my breath. And it's the same with the school. And I think that the reason why people get upset here is that we don't run school behavior entirely on sanctions and rewards. But they're necessary. So they're an integral part of it. But what we don't do is say, right, the core of it is going to be punishments. Punishments have to be there. And I say punishment. Nobody likes the word punishment. Sanctions, penalties, disincentives. People like that a bit better. But sanctions are the backstop of your behavior management. They're not the core of it, but you must have them. You know, the reason we get people to drive well by teaching them how to drive well. And you also need penalties for driving badly. If you remove those penalties, some people, maybe 5%, they'll go nuts. They'll say, well, the hell with you. If I don't have to stop at a red sign, if I can park wherever I want, and there's no penalty for it, I think I'll do it. If there's no disincentive. And here's the thing, 5% of people would do that a lot. And all people would do it sometimes if it pleased them. So you cannot assume good behavior will only occur because you've taught it. Good behavior will occur when you've taught it really well and supported kids and also created a meaningful structure of boundaries. That's where consequences sits into this. Consequences are the backstop. Consequences are one of the best ways of teaching children if they've done the right thing or the wrong thing. If you don't have consequences, they'll assume you don't care. And they'd be right. Mm. They'd be right. If I set homework and never mark it, the kid thinks you don't care about my homework. And they're right. If I say you've got to turn up on time, but kids don't turn up in time and I don't do anything about it, there's no consequence for the action, the kid will go, you don't really care about it very much, do you? And they'd be right. We demonstrate care. by insisting upon behaviors and stipulating that they must do it and challenging them when they don't. That's where consequences comes in.
For as little as the price of a cup of coffee each month, I would really appreciate it if you supported the Knowledge for Teachers podcast. While the podcast will always be available for free, your support will ensure the sustainability of it. By doing so, you will gain access to transcripts, my key takeaways from each episode, and more. So, if you can head to patreon.com/knowledgeforteacherspodcast, that would be greatly appreciated. If you are a larger organization interested in sponsoring the podcast, please contact me at brendan@learnwithlee.net. Now, let's get back to the episode.
When teachers do have students who maybe they're not kind of following classroom expectations, and that might be due to things like, you know, neurodivergence and trauma.
Yeah.
What are the best strategies that they can be using in these situations?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned those two things, like neurodivergence and neurological atypicality. And then you mentioned trauma. So that's really interesting because there are all kinds of difficulties and challenges the human psyche can face. You know, life is not easy. And all of us will go through some kind of horrible challenge at some point in our lives. If a child is neurologically atypical, that can mean 100 different things. It can mean 100 different capacities. We target the accommodation to the specific need of the child. What we don't do is say, this child's got a special need of some kind, therefore they can't behave. Nor is bad behavior always a special need. You know, it's they're not the same concept. They can overlap a lot, but they're not the same concept. So I'll give you an example. If you've got a child with Tourette's, now 10% of Tourette sufferers have got that very famous tick, you know, and sometimes the swearing and so on, which comes along with the Tourette syndrome. And I've taught children with Tourette syndrome. But what you don't do is say, oh, well, you've got Tourette's, you can't behave. I mean, that would be crazy, right? You target the accommodation, you target the exception to the specific atypicality. So I remember saying to a boy with Tourette's, he said, look, do you fancy telling the class about Tourette's? And he did. He was very happy to do so. And the class kind of shrugged their shoulders and went, oh, that sounds pretty rough. You know, there was lots of empathy. And then I said to the class, so if he swears because of his Tourette's, he can't help it. So I'll do nothing and you do nothing, right? And the class all went, yeah, okay, fair enough, that makes sense. They got it completely. And I said to the class, but if you swear, I will come down on you like the wrath of God. I will be Samuel Jackson. I will lay my vengeance upon you. Do you understand? And they all got it because they knew where I stood on swearing. And I said to the boy, and this really tied the ribbon, I said to the boy, if you swear, and it's not because of your tick, I will come down on you like the wrath of God. Do you understand? And he got it. And you know what? He kind of appreciated that because I was treating him like a human being and not just a symptom. You target the accommodation for the need. That's how you do it. It's not things like trauma. That's a really interesting one here. The word trauma has endured a great deal of concept creep in the last 70 years. It used to mean, you know, head trauma to soldiers who were literally hit in the head, and because of that, you know, had damage to the way they thought or behaved, and it's now moved on to, and then moved on to experiencing something hideous which really really damaged you, like, or going through a hideous period of your life, like, you know, like for instance, witnessing your colleagues being massacred in Vietnam or something like that, you know, that you would say that's trauma, right? Or being abused as a child, that kind of thing. And it's kind of crept in even more, and now it seems to have crept into things like, you know, perfectly common life circumstances, like going through a divorce and so on. I'd say, oh, I've had the trauma of that. Now, it's not to me to define what trauma is, but it's important to know that it has crept to mean lots and lots of things now. And the difficulty with trauma is that two people can go through the same experience, and one person can be very damaged by it, and some people aren't, and another person isn't. And so it's very difficult to say what, you know, exactly what is going to be traumatic and what isn't. Some people have much greater levels of resilience than others. Some people bounce back. Some people interpret it in different ways and think, you know, that was tough, but I'm not going to let it own me. It's difficult. It's so difficult. And so I think there's a really big misconception in schools these days, and it's really crept in hard. And I'm pushing back as much as I can, but sometimes I feel like I'm trying to push back the tide, which is this: most misbehavior in schools is not caused by trauma. The vast majority of it. And I see a lot of people talking about every single act of misbehavior and then somebody going, let's take a trauma-informed approach to this. You know, that which it's just so weird. And it's very well-meaning people who care about kids, but they've just unwittingly wholesale adopted an area of psychology which is often very, very contested, and yet they've just kind of brought it in. I think it feels right, because who doesn't want to be trauma-informed? But if you call everything trauma, then nothing is. And that does an extreme disservice to children who've been through genuinely traumatic life events and are having to deal with it.
Yeah.
So absolutely, yes, some misbehavior definitely emerges from traumatic spaces. Absolutely, without a doubt. And those kids need loads of love and support and scaffolding and all the rest of it. But if a kid tells me to F off because he's a bit lazy and bored and doesn't like my subject, I don't think, I wonder where his trauma is coming from. You know, what a nonsense. If somebody overtakes me in the motorway really dangerously, I don't think, I wonder what his need is. Oh, he needs to get home. You know, I don't think, you know, I wonder what he's trying to communicate to me here. Sometimes the therapeutic lens is not the right lens. I mean, I just say in a classroom environment, it's frequently not. I mean, almost always not. And sometimes it is, but that's mostly going to be an extra classroom experience. So we make reasonable accommodations. But you know, sorry, this is a $10 answer for, you know, a $5 question, but I'm happy to go for it. The interesting thing about children who've been through trauma and children who come from chaotic life environments and so on is that what they need in a classroom is remarkably similar to what everybody needs. They need safety. They need a calm, predictable environment where everyone knows what they should be doing. They need to be treated with dignity. They need to feel like they matter. And they normally need an authority figure in the classroom helping them to understand that they're safe, that they're calm, that things are predictable. And also it helps if you give them meaningful work, which makes them feel like they're doing something that matters. Now, these are intrinsic, fundamental needs of all human beings. It's just that people who are wounded need that a lot more. And so it's a rising tide that lifts all ships. The routines and norms and consequences and boundaries and so on, they're not just some kind of dull Professor Snape type way of running a classroom. They are the kindest way to help and support the people who are the most wounded and who need love the most.
Yeah, look, I think that's a great way to kind of finish the part on behaviour. The other area that you've had a massive impact on education is through Research Ed. You know, what initially motivated you to start Research Ed, and did you envisage it getting as big as it has?
No, oh God, no, are you kidding? I mean, I often tell this story that I was sitting on my couch at 11 o'clock at night watching, I think it was G.I. Joe, you know? I can't remember if it was Rise of Cobra, but it was definitely G.I. Joe, which is not a good film, you know? And like every heroic figure in history, I was on Twitter. So I was watching a terrible film, scrolling aimlessly. I'd already been quite upset by the level of scientific disregard that existed within education. And I'm not a scientist. I mean, one of my kind of majors at university was epistemology, you know, the theory of knowledge. How do we know what we know? What does it mean to say you know something? And I loved that. And I used to just realize that when I started to teach, people would say anything and they wouldn't justify it. They would just say, this is what you have to do. People would say, oh, kids have to work in groups. Why? Oh, it's the best way to learn. Is it? Yeah, that's how they learn. Okay. Or they would say things like, you know, yeah, don't tell kids the answers. They have to work out for themselves. Why? Oh, that's the best way to learn. Oh, okay, right, fine. And I did all this stuff, behavior, pedagogy. And then when I tried to find out why this was the case, I realized that a lot of it was just coming from kind of 19th century philosophy. It was the weirdest thing. I was like, we've all been lied to. You know, this is the audience. I felt like I'd uncovered some kind of weird conspiracy, you know, only this time I wasn't crazy. And I realized that a lot of what we were doing in education just wasn't evidence informed. Simultaneous with that, I also realized that there was an enormous burgeoning field of cognitive psychology and developmental psychology, but also things like statistics and data analysis and so on, which taught us a lot about how kids learn and how kids behave. And it was all out there, but it wasn't being taught in teacher prep. I thought, this is really strange. It was almost as if you were being trained to be a doctor. But, you know, but it was all leeches and trepanning and you know, meditation and chakras. But they wouldn't teach you about the circulatory system or something. It was so weird. And so I started to write vigorously about just phony claims in education. I think I was quite inspired by a guy called Ben Goldacre at the time, who's a British doctor and scientist who just writes about bad science all the time. He's a very good writer. I was also inspired by, you know, other heroes like Christopher Hitchens and people like that, you know, kind of iconoclasts who are very happy to, you know, poke a few sacred cows. And I realized that education was full of sacred cows and what I called a kind of a priesthood, and that it was an act of rebellion just to speak the truth, as Orwell, I think it was Orwell who said that. And I wrote just really simple blogs about that claim doesn't stand up. You'd see something in the news, that claim doesn't stand up. And eventually I was watching this film one night and tweeting, and somebody said, you know, Tom, why don't you run a conference about this? And I remember just thinking, yeah, what a good idea. Mm. So I put the first conference on, and it was all volunteers. The school gave its premises. The people spoke for nothing. People came and held. It turned up in stuffed bags. People donated a little bit of dough to pay for, you know, flyers. It was you know, let's just put the show on right here. It was a triumph of optimism and amateurism. I remember thinking that was brilliant. What a great day we had. But it wouldn't go away, despite my best efforts. It wouldn't go away. And since then, I think we've run about 300 conferences in 16 countries. And it's just gone crazy. So we're running two in Australia, one in Newcastle, one in Ballarat. In fact, the Ballarat one is coming up really soon. I should know the date offhand. I think it's like next week.
Yeah, this weekend.
This weekend. Yes. Thank you. Yeah. I'm glad you told me the run. It's just we've got like 35 conferences running just now.
Yeah.
So, you know, you'll forgive me if the dates something is coming.
By the time this is released, it would have already been.
It'll be gone. Yes. Sorry, Greg. It's run by the brilliant Greg Ash. Really, really good at this kind of stuff.
Yes.
And then Kate Barton.
I think there's still tickets for the Newcastle one.
Yeah, Newcastle. That's Kate Barton. So yeah, you get online and get buying. So yeah, that's how it started, and it just kind of took off, and it's kind of remained what it was, which is very grassroots. I mean, we don't have any capital. We try to zero cost every event, and it's, you know, it's just been a volunteer driven effort for the past 10 years, and it's been a labor of love, and I love it. But it's cost me so many sleepless nights. But it's been such a wonderful thing to see, because it's so altruistic. You know, people just give so freely of their time, and that's why the tickets are so low in terms of price, because you get to see like 15 speakers are all, you know, blow your mind about something that you're interested in, and you can select the day you want, and it's like 50, you know, it's like 50, 60 bucks or something, and you get lunch. I mean, I can't sell it any better than that, because normally a lot of the professional development I used to go to, it was like $700, you know, for a full day, and it might be somebody who was rubbish, and schools were paying for this. And I just remember thinking, you know, we're all being conned here. The professional development shouldn't be like this. In fact, you shouldn't have to pay for it. It should be in your teacher prep, but it's not often. So people have to go to these kind of things. So that's why I started it. And it's meant to be a kind of an antidote to the lawlessness and the guesswork, which frequently exists. And, it, you know, a lot of people do not like it. A lot of people get really upset by it and say, you know, you horrible scientifically driven monsters. But I don't give a damn. You know, we are pushing forward this debate and discussion, and it's not about coming up with definitive final answers and saying, you know, you must do it like this. It's about looking for the best evidence we have and running with it, but always remaining skeptical and open to nuance and subtlety and, you know, when is this right and when is this wrong? It's kind of working out what works, but also when and why and when it doesn't. And I think that's a much healthier place to be. People say teaching is a profession. I don't think it's a profession yet. I think it's like a demi-profession, maybe a quasi-profession, because we don't have an agreed body of professional domain expertise like doctors might have. And, you know, doctors still have disputes about what treatment to use and what medicine to use and when, but at least they can agree on certain basic principles of chemistry and physics and biology. You know, there's a body of evidence that suggests the heart is here, typically, and the eyes are here, typically. Sorry for your podcasters, I'm pointing at where these things are. You know, there's agreement about a certain level of the model, of the paradigm, which we don't have in education yet, and that's what we're trying to build.
Yeah. Look, I think in Australia, like, we're really fortunate at the moment where there are there's a really strong movement of educators who are pushing for, you know, the things that you're talking about when it comes to the science of learning.
Oh, it's really helpful. Yeah. There's loads of people in Australia doing a lot of work here.
Yeah, and you know, just for instance, this weekend, I think there are about 3 or 4 different conferences on around the country. Yeah, all kind of pushing the same message. And yeah, it's just by putting it out there, making it accessible for teachers, it means that, like you mentioned a number of times today, more children are going to get access to evidence-based education.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. It's been a joy to see. Australia is a utopia in many ways. You know, I love Australia. I think every time I go to Australia, you always think, yeah, you also have to give yourself reasons to leave Australia. It's so bloody lovely. The people are great. The weather, but it's beautiful. The cultures are amazing. You know, and you go back to kind of rainy Britain, where everyone's kind of moaning each other. And you think, oh God, what have I done wrong? I took my family there in October. And they were there for the first time. And they were like, Daddy, can we stay? I was like, no, we cannot stay. This isn't Bluey. Go home. Go be miserable. I'm kidding. We live in Scotland. It's lovely. We live in the country. But there's one thing the UK does really well now. And I think that we really have moved on, or in the English system at least, in terms of pedagogy, curriculum, behavior, and so on. There has been some great movement there. And we do so many things badly. I mean, our it's like a clown show sometimes over here. But we do this really pretty well. We've got better. And what's exciting for me is that the types of conversations you're having in Oz now are the quality and the intensity, and they've got the same level of ambition and energy that I remember seeing in the UK like say, kind of 7-8 years ago. I'm not saying you're behind. That's not the point. The point is that it's just taken a little while for that to really explode in Oz, because you've had a lot of resistance. But there are so many iconoclasts now in Australia. There's so many people who are saying, no, look, this is the evidence that we have. You can't deny this level of evidence. You know, give me better evidence. That there's now, it's kind of a war. And I see quite a lot going on online, and certainly when I'm over there and sort of the pushback we get sometimes. But you know what? I am at peace with this war. I am at peace with this war. Parabellum. If you want peace, prepare for war. Thanks, Kiana. And it's true. You know, it's true. And I think it's a healthy process. And I think before things get better, there'll be a lot more debates than disagreements. But you know what? That discourse is so healthy. It is so healthy. Mm. And good things will come of it. And good things are coming of it. So it's a delight to see Australia moving the way it's doing.
Yeah. Tom, as we get to the end of today's conversation, I've really enjoyed it. Just the last couple of questions. What's on the horizon for you?
Well, for me right now, it's 10 o'clock in the morning, so I'm going to have some late breakfast. It's probably going to be some kind of granola. Okay, I'm kidding. No, I mean, I really am going to have that. But I've got the thrill. I'm actually going to be coming back over, because the last time I came over in October, I did a little bit of work with some leaders and teachers. And it was largely, you know, bringing my family over, but I had to do some work to justify it. And there was such an appetite over there. There's such a great conversation now about behavior. People are really looking in the right direction for, you know, what do we do? How do we improve? You know, and there's some people doing some amazing work over there. And so what I'm going to do is I'm coming over in May. I'm going to be in lots of places, but I'm going to be in Perth on the 11th and Sydney on the 14th and Melbourne on the 18th. And I'm going to be doing some teacher training days that people can book onto. I'm doing some other ones for leaders too. I'm going to announce them probably this week, next few days. But those are the three main ones. So it's Perth on the 11th, Sydney the 14th, Melbourne the 18th. And I would love it if people came along and we could have like a workshop and a training day, and we could just discuss behavior. And also I'm going to be visiting some schools. I'm going to be talking to some people in the ministries and try to talk to some key players and just see how we can move the needle there. So I'm really looking forward to coming over. It's going to be work, but it's going to be fun. It's going to be fun work. So I look forward to seeing everyone when I come over there.
Is it, that's May, was it?
That's this May. That's coming a couple of months, yeah.
Awesome. Last question. What other bits of knowledge or resources would you recommend for teachers and school leaders?
Oh, that's a great one. Oh, I haven't been asked that for ages. I'm going to lean back in some old familiar, some old favorites. There's one book I think every teacher should read, every educator, and it's called Why Don't Students Like School by Daniel Willingham. I think it is a seminal text. I really do. It's written by one of the best cognitive psychologist in the world, and he writes it for teachers, and it is, and for anyone really, for parents too, but it is so user-friendly. What do we know about learning? What can we reasonably say we know about learning? And it's brilliant. I would also recommend, and this is more a kind of a, I would read Daisy Christodoulou's Seven Myths of Education, because it's such a, I mean, it's old now in terms of books, but it's such a great, almost punk detonation of some of the biggest myths in education, which have perpetuated and held us back. I would also recommend, Carl Hendrick's got a great book called What Does This Look Like in the Classroom? And it's really, really good for translating and discussing seminal research texts about what, you know, what we should really know I'm not saying every teacher doesn't have to be a researcher or an expert. Every teacher should know the basics of what works in classrooms and what tends not to work. And this is going to be dreadful, but I'm going to recommend my book. And I know I'm going to hell for saying this, but Running the Room is... And the reason why I think everyone should read that in terms of the classroom is that I generally think it's the best behavior book of behavior out there, because I wrote it and I wanted it to be the best behavior because I wanted it to be practical and evidence-informed, but also something that people could use. And the sad thing, or perhaps happy for me, is that the competition is not great. You know, there's very, very few good books out there in terms of behavior. Bill Rogers is really good, you know, your countryman. I loved his stuff. He was one of my biggest influences and one of the most useful people I've ever read. And I know that he's still plugging away and doing the Lord's work. So good on you, Bill, if you ever hear this. So, and thanks for everything you did. There you go. That's just a few texts offhand.
Yeah, look, great list there. And yeah, I've spoken to Daisy Christodoulou for the podcast and she was amazing.
Oh, she's great, isn't she? She can talk legs off donkey. She can talk for England, man. You have to stop her talking. She's brilliant. Can I just say, she's one of the cleverest people I've ever met. She's such a polymath. It's really annoying. I find it makes me feel quite small and stupid, but I'm so glad that she exists.
Yeah. And I love how you made that link to, you know, like the punk rock style, because like when you think about when she wrote that book, she was, you know, a young female, you know, butting heads against some, you know, pretty big thinkers, you know, in the game. So hats off to her for what she was able to achieve. And yeah, I agree. Yeah, Why Don't Students Like School? I love that book as well.
Yeah, she is the absolute antidote to people like Guy Claxton and Ken Robinson and so on, who are, you know, both really well-meaning people, but you know, Olympic levels of being wrong about education.
Tom Bennett, thank you for today. Fascinating conversation, and I'm sure it'll be really useful for a lot of teachers out there. So yeah, thank you for your time.
Brendan, thanks. Lovely to speak to you. Hope to meet you someday. You take it easy, mate.
Thank you.
I know that Tom Bennett can be quite divisive, but I'm hoping that this conversation was able to clear up some of the conjecture. Here are my key takeaways. We're not born with our behaviours. If you stand for anything, people will throw bricks. I loved his analogy of how we were all like Professor X and overexposed to the thoughts of everyone in the universe. We need to apply pedagogy to teaching behaviour. Teach them what you want them to do, rather than assuming. Every society, every community has to have boundaries of acceptable behaviour and consequences for crossing those boundaries. Your behaviour curriculum should be paired up with the training manual. Coming up, you'll hear from Bronwyn Rari-Jones, an instructional coach and professional learning provider, who will delve into responsive teaching and how to enact it in the classroom. However, that's it from me for today, and as always, stay curious, keep learning, and teach with purpose. Bye for now.